Hello, and welcome to the Great War Podcast, an in-depth look at the origins, battles, and consequences of the First World War. Episode 82, The Kornilov Affair. Hello everyone, and welcome back. Last episode, we discussed Maria Botchkareva and the Women's Battalion of Death. This episode, we will cover the Kornilov Affair, which took place in September 1917. After the Kerensky Offensive, Russia's political and economic health deteriorated. The provisional government scrambled to hold power while opposition grew. Following the attack, the government shuffled itself, hoping to find that magic formula. Alexander Kerensky was appointed prime minister, and cabinet positions were filled by appointees from across the political spectrum. As the new prime minister, Kerensky became the target of public vitriol, while his critics waited in the wings. Opportunism reigned supreme, and as the politicians sniped and plotted, there emerged a man who found himself at a fulcrum. This man was Lvov Kornilov, a military intelligence officer whose meteoric rise to fame is matched by his meteoric collapse to infamy. Kornilov's life story reads like it was ripped from the pages of antiquity. Born in Kazakhstan in August 1870, his career took him from the furthest frontiers of the empire to the political centers of Moscow and Petrograd. He served in the Russo-Japanese War and was decorated for bravery. Afterwards, he served as a military attaché to China, India, Afghanistan, and Iran. By many accounts, Kornilov was observant and studious. He mastered a half dozen languages and was writing a book on Chinese history before the Great War broke out. At a time when most Russian officers hailed from the aristocracy, Kornilov's humble upbringing endeared him to the rank and file. He was energetic, brash, and daring. According to Orlando Figes, he was magnetic and had developed a cult of personality. This cult of personality was best exemplified by the Praetorian-like bodyguards who followed him everywhere. Even as he moved up the ranks, Kornilov continued to shun the lifestyle of high society. He declined a posting to St. Petersburg, opting to return to his home province. Kerensky would write of Kornilov, quote, "He remained all his life a man of simple tastes, a man of the people. There was nothing of the hereditary bureaucrat or of the aristocratic landed noble in him." End quote. For better or for worse, the Great War changed Kornilov's career. He was made a general and given a divisional command in 8th Army. In April 1915, his division was cut off and isolated, fighting the Austrians near the Carpathian foothills. Kornilov refused to retreat and was subsequently captured. He spent the next few months as the Austrians' prisoner. He was treated well. His captors gave him plenty of reading materials, including books on Napoleon and the French Revolution. Following the Corsican's footsteps, Kornilov made a daring escape in July 1916, making his way back to Russia on foot. His heroic odyssey elevated him to celebrity status and turned him into a quasi-folk hero. After Tsar Nicholas abdicated the throne, Kornilov was put in charge of the Petrograd garrison. This would be his first encounter with revolutionary law. As we've covered, Petrograd was a hotbed of political activism. Demonstrations, protests, and worker strikes were regular occurrences. Whoever had the responsibility of protecting law and order also had to balance the old laws with the new. In any event, Kornilov's time in Petrograd was not memorable. When another round of demonstrations began in April 1917, Kornilov deployed the garrison and ordered it to open fire. By doing so, he had overlooked one key detail. He did not ask the Soviet first. His order was annulled as a result. This was an embarrassing setback for the young general, and he resigned his post soon after. Following his stint in the capital, Kornilov returned to 8th Army just in time for the Kerensky Offensive. Embittered by his experiences in Petrograd, Kornilov went against the Soviet by reintroducing capital punishment. Any soldier who abandoned their post was to be shot, while military police kept an ear to the ground for signs of unrest. Although these draconian measures went against revolutionary sentiment, the troops responded well. According to observers, 8th Army's performance was one of the few bright spots from the campaign. The men fought coherently and dealt major damage to the Austrian defenses in western Ukraine. As we saw in episode 80, the Kerensky offensive was an abysmal failure. However, Kornilov's leadership had caught the attention of Kerensky's critics. They saw Kornilov as the archetypal strongman, a strict disciplinarian who could galvanize the troops. In other words, Kornilov was their golden ticket, a blunt instrument to be wielded in their crusade against Kerensky and the revolution. But here's the thing. Kornilov cared not a hoot. He was no political operator. He was a soldier. Diplomacy was of little interest to him, and although he never publicly opposed the government, he knew a loyal and disciplined army was necessary if Russia was to remain afoot. It is perhaps a tad ironic that his future rival Kerensky shared the same view. On July 29th, Kerensky summoned his army commanders to figure out why the offensive went so poorly. As expected, the assembled officers blamed everyone and everything but themselves. They cited the lack of morale. They cursed the Soviet and Order No. 1. Brusilov blamed the Bolsheviks and their, quote, criminal propaganda, unquote. To be fair, their excuses had merit, and although there was enough brass to start a band, none of the officers tabled viable solutions. Surprisingly, Kornilov did not attend the meeting. He opted to remain at the front. He did, however, send his chief of staff, who read a prepared statement on his behalf. Rather than blame outside factors, Kornilov argued Russia's problems were internal and could be solved through tough yet pragmatic measures. Using 8th Army as a model, Kornilov called for an army-wide restoration of capital punishment, along with the return of military tribunals. This, he argued, was the best way to combat Bolshevik support. Finally, he called for a, quote, purification of high command, implying poor leadership was ultimately to blame. In his memoir, Kerensky writes he was deeply troubled by Kornilov's statement. It opposed the central pillars of the revolution. Yet, like Kornilov, Kerensky needed the army support if his government was to stay in power. Kerensky had no military ethos of his own, whereas the 47-year-old Kornilov was the rising star. On July 31st, so just 2 days after, Kerensky made a risky yet calculated move. He dismissed Brusilov and offered Kornilov the job of commander-in-chief. Why Kerensky did this is threefold. One, he needed a functioning army, and Kornilov was the guy to do it. Two, he wanted to appease the monarchists who had grown weary of the new regime. Lastly, it sent a clear message to both the Entente and the Bolsheviks. By appointing a strict disciplinarian, it reaffirmed Russia's commitment to the war. Good for the Entente, bad for Lenin and Co. Emboldened by his newfound fame, Kornilov did not accept the job right away. He wanted Kerensky's word that the government would follow through on what he proposed on July 29th. He then tacked on two additional requests. He wanted complete autonomy over military affairs, thereby defanging the Soviet and granting him total control over planning, logistics, and staffing. That was his first request. His second request was a bit different. Kornilov was to be the supreme moral authority of Russia, accountable to himself and to the nation as a whole. These requests did not endear him to Kerensky. The Prime Minister agreed in principle, but opted to punt further considerations. Kornilov did not accept the job until August 2nd, but wasted no time in implementing his program for restoring discipline. While the two men remained divided on several issues, they agreed on one thing. Petrograd was a political powder keg waiting to blow. They needed a plan if and when things popped off. What made Petrograd so contentious, you ask? Well, on July the 15th, the Bolsheviks had attempted to seize power. This was the start of the July days, which lasted until July 17th. The Bolshevik attempt was disorganized and unsuccessful. Lenin and Trotsky pulled their support at the last minute. Lenin fled, and Trotsky was arrested. Although the Bolsheviks took it on the chin, the July days showed how fragile things had become. To avoid a repeat, Kerensky and Kornilov beefed up the city garrison and named a special detachment that would be sent to the city if things went sideways. This special detachment was the 3rd Cavalry Corps, commanded by General Alexander Krymov. The 3rd Cav was stationed just south of the city and would be deployed by rail in the event of further unrest. Now, you'll want to remember Krymov and Third Corps because they will come back later. Krymov, Third Corps. Krymov, Third Corps. Quite important. Things were off to a rocky start, to say the least, and it was not long before Kerensky and Kornilov's relationship turned sour. Kornilov remained at army headquarters in Mogilev. Kerensky moved to the Winter Palace, where he ate, slept 3 hours a night, and tried to run the country from the same rooms as the Romanovs. Meanwhile, tensions on the street remained high. Nearly 400,000 workers went on strike, and more soldiers deserted from the ranks. Soldiers and civilians lingered on the streets, congregating around hastily erected bonfires. They swapped stories and discussed rumors, giving rise to a self-inflicted fifth column that percolated through the ranks. Within this simmering cocktail of fear, anger, and growing partisanship, Kerensky hoped to find common ground. He summoned leading bureaucrats and intelligentsia to a state conference on August 12th. The conference was to be held in Moscow's Grand Bolshoi Theater. Kerensky called the conference because he wanted to bring together the increasingly fragmented representatives of Russian politics. He hoped it would allow him to survey the political landscape and give the opposition a chance to voice their concerns. In all, 2,400 delegates arrived. Among them were military and business leaders, industrialists, academics, politicians, Soviet representatives, and members of the aristocracy. Lenin officially boycotted the event, so no Bolsheviks attended. As one might expect when you pack 2,400 people with opposing views into a single room, the conference divulged into a gamut of demands, accusations, defenses, and complaints. Kerensky opened the proceedings with a fiery speech, in which he promised to defend his government with blood and iron. He also stressed the necessity for a strong, unifying authority. One after another, speakers took the podium to voice their demands. While Kerensky may have called the conference in good faith, it was crystal clear how polarized the system was. All one had to do was look at how the delegates were seated in the auditorium. The left-wing parties sat left of the stage, while the conservatives took the right. Kerensky's moderates sat in the middle. Kornilov's arrival on August the 13th marked the high point of the conference. The general received a celebrity's welcome. Onlookers packed the streets to catch a glimpse. Dressed in an immaculate uniform, he was escorted to the Bolshoi by his Praetorian guard. Once outside the theater, his guards hoisted him on their shoulders and carried him inside. This was Kornilov's introduction to the public. If you're interested, I've included a photo of Kornilov's arrival up on the website, thegreatwarpodcast.podbean.com. Despite the showman's entrance, Kornilov's speech was remarkably bland. He spoke of conditions at the front. He placed special emphasis on the situation in Latvia. We'll come back to this in just a moment. He called for the creation of an army with a, quote, iron discipline, unquote. He also spoke of expanding officer authority to improve munitions productions. Nothing he said was inflammatory. He did not denounce the government. He did not attack Kerensky. Nothing he said really mattered. It was never about what Kornilov said, but what Kornilov stood for. Or, more accurately, what his supporters believed slash wanted him to stand for. For those who wanted to restore a pre-revolutionary Russia, Kornilov was their man. He was the chosen one to save Russia from those pesky revolutionaries. After the conference ended and the delegates went their separate ways, Kerensky and Kornilov met for a final time on August the 19th. Kerensky informed him he would accept his proposals from August 2nd, those being the proposals on capital punishment and repurposing of Krymov's 3rd Cavalry Corps. Kornilov left the city believing his plans had been approved, and this will have major implications moving forward. Meanwhile, the Germans watched developments in Russia with great interest. Eager to pounce on a demoralized enemy, Ludendorff looked to make a move in Latvia. His objective was to capture Riga, the capital city. In 1917, Riga was the fourth largest city in the Russian Empire, and had a pre-war population of 500,000. This included large numbers of Baltic Germans. Situated 576 kilometers from Petrograd, according to Google Maps' driving instructions, Riga offered the Germans several advantages. It offered a deep water port and put Petrograd within a week's marching distance. While there were no set plans to march on Petrograd, Ludendorff believed this would be a useful threat in Tarum, maybe enough to force Russia to terms. The task of capturing Riga fell to the German 8th Army, commanded by General Oskar von Heuter. I hope I got that correctly. Von Heuter deployed specially trained stormtroopers for the assault, emphasizing speed and overwhelming firepower. The vanguard would advance through corridors created by the artillery, then bypass enemy strongpoints by focusing on the nerve center of the Russian defenses. In other words, forget the guns and trenches. Focus on the communication, supply, and command centers. Bridges, crossroads, and rail stations were also given elevated priority. If successful, these attacks would short-circuit the Russian defenses, allowing the regular infantry to mop up afterwards. Riga was to be the acid test for these new tactics, and they would soon be deployed on the Western Front. Riga was attacked on September 1st, just 2 weeks after the Moscow Conference. German batteries fired 20,000 gas shells, which scattered the garrison in panicked retreat. Supported by 650 guns and 500 mortars, the Germans made an amphibious landing across the Duna River. They quickly established a bridgehead and took 9,000 prisoners. The Russians, perhaps unwilling to sacrifice more men in a lost cause, withdrew from the city the following day. The Germans marched into Riga on September 4th with 9 divisions in tow. It was a thrashing victory in every sense of the word. The Russians took 25,000 casualties. The Germans, just 4,200. In Berlin, Kaiser Wilhelm toasted the victory. He ordered a national day of celebration and rewarded von Heuter with the highest military honors. Back in Petrograd, the news generated mixed reactions. On the one hand, its loss was another government failure. On the other, many Russians believed Riga had been an incubator for revolutionary ideals. The German population had historically been viewed with suspicion. Wherever one stood on the issue, Riga's loss profoundly impacted the political climate. With the Germans now on their doorstep, Kerensky and Kornilov went for each other's throats. Kornilov accused the government of incompetence. Kerensky shot back, accusing Kornilov of abandoning Riga on purpose. As Nick Cornish writes in his book on the Russian army in the Great War, quote, Kornilov was very inactive during the attack. He issued no orders, nor did he transfer reserves to the area. End quote. So, we are about 2,500 words into this episode, and we can finally, officially, get to the actual Kornilov affair. About time. It all started on September 4th, when Kerensky had an unexpected visitor at the Winter Palace. The visitor was Vladimir Nikolaevich Lvov, a pro-revolutionary radical who played a key role in Rasputin's murder. Although sympathetic to the revolution, Lvov served as the church's chief prosecutor from March to July. Details are a bit sketchy, but from what I understand, Lvov had run afoul with the bishops and earned a reputation of being overly emotional and authoritarian. Peeling another layer from the onion, Lvov left the church in July, seeking a cabinet post in Kerensky's new government. Kerensky had other ideas. He passed on Lvov, leaving him in the political wilderness. In any event, Lvov informed Kerensky of, well, something. He did not provide names and carefully avoided words like coup, plot, overthrow, or any other synonyms. Kerensky describes Lvov as being cagey and sidestepping any questions about who he represented. Lvov alluded to Kerensky's waning influence, something Kerensky was well aware of. Lvov asked if Kerensky would be open to include, quote, new elements in the government, but did not elaborate on what these new elements pertained to. It must have been a strange conversation. In his memoir, Kerensky admits feeling a bit confused. He writes, quote, I thought the matter would end at that. Generally speaking, I did not attach any importance to it, but some of the details, and more particularly Lvov's scheming, attracted my attention. It must not be forgotten that it was a time of all sorts of talk and idle scheming. End quote. After his dialogue with Kerensky, Lvov left the Winter Palace and hopped a southbound train to Kornilov's headquarters in Mogilev. Mirroring his conversation with Kerensky, Lvov asked the general what governmental changes he would like to see. Kornilov probably responded with some cookie-cutter answer. Then, Lvov approached the idea of establishing a dictatorship. This dictatorship, according to Lvov, could take three possible forms. The first form would see Kerensky as sole ruler. The second form, with Kornilov as sole ruler. The third form was a joint rulership between Kerensky and Kornilov. Kornilov said he would prefer to take the post for himself, but he also made clear he supported the idea of sharing power with Kerensky. Now, it's possible Kornilov was just paying lip service, but by supporting a shared government, it does suggest he was not planning anything nefarious. Most importantly, Kornilov made clear that he and Kerensky had to meet before any constitutional changes were made. Armed with this new information, Lvov departed Mogilev and returned to Petrograd. Back at the Winter Palace, Lvov presented Kerensky with a mutilated account of what Kornilov had said. According to Lvov, the commander-in-chief wanted to be dictator, and wanted Petrograd placed under martial law. Kerensky was shaken by what he heard. This was the long-suspected counter-revolution, a repeat of the July days. Kerensky had to move fast if his government was to survive. Lvov was arrested, and Kerensky started making moves to protect his government. What transpired next is something quite remarkable. Kerensky needed evidence of Kornilov's guilt, so he sent a telegram asking Kornilov to confirm what he had said. Kerensky did not sign the telegram with his name. He used Lvov's name, and tricked Kornilov into believing the telegram was from him. On that point, Kerensky did not specify for Kornilov which message he was confirming. Was it the martial law one? The dictatorship one? Kornilov had no way of knowing. Had Kornilov been more versed in the political arts, he may have thought twice before responding, or at least gotten an advisor to read it over first. Without his staff's knowledge, the general confirmed Kerensky's message, and repeated the two should meet for further talks. Kornilov's response gave Kerensky the evidence he needed. In the wee hours of September 9th, Kerensky summoned his cabinet ministers and briefed them on Kornilov's treachery. This was a threat to their very existence, Kerensky said. To save the regime, the ministers had to resign and cede power. Several hours of intense debate followed, but at 6 a.m. the ministers fell in line. One by one they resigned, handing their power to Kerensky. The prime minister was now a dictator. With his new powers unlocked, Kerensky telegrammed Kornilov and demanded his resignation. Kornilov was still in Mogilev, some 780 kilometers from Petrograd, according to Google Maps' driving instructions. It took time for news to travel, and there was no way for Kornilov to know the government had resigned, and Kerensky was now dictator. Muddying the waters further, Kerensky's telegram was sparsely detailed. It had no official letterheads, numbers, or signature. Kerensky signed his name, but did not include his government title. From Kornilov's camp, it read as though Kerensky had temporarily lost his mind. Or, perhaps a coup had taken place, and Kerensky was now a prisoner. Kornilov did not respond to Kerensky's resignation demand. It was clear things were not right in the capital. Two plausible theories emerged, neither of which painted Kerensky in a positive light. One theory saw Kerensky toppled by another Bolshevik insurrection, but it wasn't October yet, so that couldn't be the case. The second theory suggested Kerensky was working with the Bolsheviks, but Kerensky hated them as much as Kornilov, so that couldn't be it either. The tragedy here is that this misunderstanding could have been cleared up with a phone call. Just another example of two dudes living in the moment without a phone in sight. To protect the capital, Kornilov did what he said he would do. He ordered Krymov's 3rd Cavalry Corps to Petrograd. He also released a statement calling the population to arms. I, General Kornilov, son of a peasant Cossack, announce to all and everyone that I personally desire nothing save the preservation of our great Russia, and vow to lead the people through victory over our enemies. Whether Kornilov's intentions were sincere remains a source of academic debate. Neither he nor Kerensky fully understood what was happening. Through trickery, Kerensky had accused Kornilov of treason, whereas Kornilov, unknowingly, committed treason by ordering an armed unit to the city. As Third Corps made its way north, the mood in Petrograd became tense. Civil war appeared imminent. People locked themselves indoors. Military checkpoints and barricades were erected in the streets. Kerensky ordered newspapers to publish special editions condemning Kornilov and calling for every man, woman, and child to defend their homes against the usurper. News of Kornilov's supposed treachery spread through the city like wildfire. It also resulted in an unlikely alliance. As Krymov's troops reached the city's outskirts, the Bolsheviks and Petrograd Soviet found common cause. The Bolsheviks and Soviet had no love for Kerensky, but a Kornilov-led conservative coup was the worst-case scenario. They feared if Kornilov seized power, the revolution would be undone. Anyone who opposed him would be strung up on lampposts. Put simply, Kerensky was the lesser of two evils. The Soviet and Bolsheviks presented a united front and pledged to protect the government. This new, albeit temporary, coalition was called the Committee for Struggle with Counter-Revolution. For narrative's sake, I'll refer to it as the CSCR. Declaring their members had a duty to defend the revolution, 40,000 urban workers were called to arms. Kerensky's government supplied weapons and ammunition, thereby arming thousands of Bolshevik operators. Outside the city, rail line workers took control of stations and began ripping up the tracks. Krymov and Third Corps was halted a day's journey from the city. The Kornilov affair came to a sputtering halt on September 12th. CSCR delegates met General Krymov in a regional town 2 hours south of Petrograd. Krymov was taken to the Winter Palace, where he learned the truth. The provisional government still held power. There was no threat to the city. Neither was Kerensky a Bolshevik prisoner. After learning his entire mission had been a fake, Krymov became despondent. He left for a friend's apartment and wrote a short note announcing his resignation. Then he drew his service pistol and shot himself through the heart. Lavar Kornilov was arrested the following day. He and 30 other officers spent the next month in prison. Kerensky's government survived, but its influence was irreparably damaged. Kerensky had no allies on the right. This left him exposed to the growing threat from the left, namely the Bolsheviks and more radical elements of the Soviet. Kerensky had also made a fatal error. His decision to arm the CSCR emboldened his enemies. Several Bolshevik leaders, Trotsky among them, were released from prison in exchange for their support, while Lenin returned from exile soon after. It is no coincidence that less than a month later, the Bolsheviks would make their move, pulling Russia from the war and changing world history forever. Lavar Kornilov never stood trial. He escaped prison during the chaos of October 1917. He fled east and joined the anti-Bolshevik White Army during the Civil War. In April 1918, Kornilov was killed in action. So, as we've spent the past few episodes in Russia, I do feel it is time to extract ourselves. Next episode, we'll head back over to Flanders. The Battle of Third Ypres, aka Passchendaele, was about to begin. That's it for this episode. Thank you all for listening. As always, be sure to check out our website at thegreatwarpodcast.podbean.com. If you wish to leave positive or negative feedback, you can do so on Twitter. Our handle is @GreatWarPodcast. That again is @GreatWarPodcast. Or you can send an email to thegreatwarpodcast@outlook.com. That again is thegreatwarpodcast@outlook.com. Sources for this episode include Nick Cornish, The Russian Army in the First World War, Michael Nyberg and David Jordan, The Eastern Front, Prit Bratar, The Splintered Empires, Orlando Feigs, A People's Tragedy, The Russian Revolution, The Catastrophe and Prelude to Bolshevism, both written by Kerensky, James D. White, The Kornilov Affair, published in Soviet Studies 1968. Harry Asher, The Kornilov Affair, published in the Russian Review, July 1970. And lastly, Ivan Sablin, The State Conference in Moscow 1917, published by Parliaments, Estates, and Representation, February 2022. This has been episode 82 of the Great War Podcast. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you again shortly.